Paul, we have heard all day long is that some Marines were killed with friendly fire. How the media loves to play up that which is designed, and that's what it is, it's designed to chill the will of the people in this country to continue this war. Now, what I say is going to sound callous, and it is not at all. Turn me down a little. I mean, there's not one American life in the Gulf that, in my judgment, isn't worth everybody else that's over there with something left over to the American side. Now you turn me almost, find it in the middle, too loud or too low. No life in the Gulf that is to be considered anything less than more precious than any one else over there. You say, well, I think that's awful. Well, think what you will. That's my opinion. But at the same time, I think if I was doing my job on the front line and my buddies were doing their job, those are the risks that go along with close fire contact, I would rather be hit by my own side than the other side, if you're going to have to go. Because it proves they were up where the action was. And anybody with an ounce of common sense knows that that's part of the action. General Schwarzkopf himself said he didn't like it, but he remembered being bombed, and in that case, not because he was just in the midst of a firefight. Somebody called the bombs in on him, and was a mistake. Unrelentingly, the press has pursued this, what I think is an absolute irrelevant piece of subject matter. Unrelentingly. And in so doing, they reveal their true motives to make us look bad. I am absolutely amazed that the military gave that information. But they're under such unremitting attack, and it is so apparent that apart from giving out information that jeopardizes the troops and breaches security, they are bending over backwards to be forthright. I mean, are we going to analyze every single vehicle that's hit and every single tank that's hit? And have a middle-of-the-war trial in every case to see where the shell came from that hit them? I mean, if we're going to talk about friendly fire, let's talk about whether or not the particular vehicle was where it was supposed to be anyway. I mean, this is premeditated, pre-designed, flushing out of evidence in isolation and separate from anything else in the field of evidence, designed to make us look bad. And to chill the spirit and the will of our pilots by putting in them the nagging fear every time they go out and drop cluster bombs, we better circle twice and three times to make sure that no vehicle has wandered into the area. I mean, there are other things of evidence. Were planes in that area looking for targets of opportunity, or was it an assigned area of carpet bombing and cluster bombing that maybe someone wandered to for? I said it'll sound callous because every life is precious. But in the midst of the battle, now that the boys are dead, they have robbed those Marines. Robbed those Marines of the joy in the midst of the sorrow of coming home heroes who faced enemy fire. I mean, can't we have any decency in the media at all? There are certain things the public doesn't have a right to know. And all we hear all day long, B-52 crashes in the Indian Ocean. And they're screaming, if you can't give us the body count on this side, will you give it on the other side? So they can mount up the figures and somehow characterize us as mass murderers. I'm so tired of the civilian hits in Baghdad being featured, and I've looked at that scrawny little woman screaming, we are human beings, played over and over and over and over again. If she's a human being, why doesn't she scream at that madman that they've let rule them? The Kurds were human beings. The Iraqis were human beings. But the press finally found a woman enraged, screaming. In Iraq. And she's had star billing. Hour after hour, we got to look at this scrawny woman. The only thing as I look close at her that I'm sorry about is that she didn't get killed instead of somebody else. Oh, what a terrible thing to say. I wish the broad was dead. Standing there screaming at the West, indicting all of us as though we are mass murderers. Her very words focused with exclusive hatred toward the West proves that she is a supporter of Saddam, having no qualms of conscience. Maybe this is happening because we've supported genocide in our own nation. Wherein you judge another, you're guilty yourself. That's the warning about judging. And the media just plays her over and over and over again because she's truly saying what they want heard. I mean, they lost. The media is the poorest losers I've ever seen. They lost. The public is against them. And they will not learn by it. They must continue to defend their position and propagandize this nation. All you have to do is look at the remnants of a scud that hit in Saudi Arabia today to see how much damage a shot down scud can do. And they hunt for that opportunity. But the way in which they present it is not. And I'm sure there are some. I'm sure they could find a real mad Arab woman that would say some things about we are human beings and why is Saddam Hussein doing this? Nobody in their right mind believes that there is not a single Arab woman in Saudi Arabia that can scream hatred towards Saddam. I saw him rather quickly leave a screaming woman in Israel who was standing amidst the ruins of a scud remnant that fell. I'm very sure there are some eloquent Jewish women who can scream hatred to Saddam into a camera. But the color or tone on which they taint, or with which they taint the presentation of a scud remnant falling in Israel or Saudi Arabia, is to put the flavor of the presentation to emphasize the failure of the patriots to protect. When it is a deliberate target, everyone knows that, randomly selected in population areas, that the remnants of the shot-down scud still can wipe out an apartment complex and leave a crater in the ground. Yet when they show these selected scenes in Baghdad, they even have the cue, the obvious cue, that they are seeking to shoot down the Tomahawk cruise missiles. And some of the most spectacular video shown thus far in the war are those videos in this past week of the cruise missiles streaking into Baghdad. We have objective witnesses by a member of the news media herself coming out of Baghdad who saw a cruise missile coming at the hotel, turning like it was following a street map, going around the hotel and then pursuing its target. I looked at those cruise missiles and watching them sort of thought, you know, with the right kind of weapon, that's no harder to hit than some speed-flying teal, those little teal ducks that fly about 50 to 60 miles an hour. About like hitting some quail that I've shot in the foothills of California. And I thought to myself, give me the right weapon, I'll bet I could hit one of those. And it is obvious they have shot some down. Well, what makes anyone think that a shot-down cruise missile carrying a much bigger warhead than a scud missile falling in a residential area won't wreak the same kind of havoc that a scud missile remnant parts creates when it lands, as it did today in Saudi Arabia or in Tel Aviv? But you get the flavor as it's played over and over again, no commentary. Oh, they give the little byline is being censored, but then in order to make sure that they stand above Americanized viewpoint, they also say everything else is censored. Again and again, we get the propaganda out of Baghdad of civilian sites being destroyed, selectively picked, could just as easily have been destroyed in many cases by AAA falling back down on the same city, in some cases are the result of them shooting down cruise missiles, which certainly takes the responsibility away from the United States for the place that it hits. There's a big difference between scud missiles shot into residential areas at random being shot down and the remnant causing less havoc than the scud falling at random without being shot down. On a scale of objective journalistic analysis, in one case, you're shooting at random for population areas. You're trying to shoot them down with Patriot missiles, and the remnants cause damage in spite of that. In Baghdad, precision Tomahawk missiles targeting military sites are shot down, and I'm quite sure in his bunker, Saddam wants them shot down because it's more useful to him, knowing that eventually all the military targets are going to be hit anyway. It's more useful to him to hit one of them and have it destroy a population civilian area because he can use it for propaganda. But in every case, the way they color the reporting, we're the civilian murderers in Baghdad, and our patriots aren't working as well as they should in Israel and Saudi Arabia. There is a continuous conspiracy to accentuate the anti-war frame of reference, the anti-American frame of reference, a continuous conspiracy being expressed to accentuate any weakness or any mistake on our side, while uncritically, except for a byline, this is being censored. We are fed the propaganda from Baghdad. Now, I have some comments in a rather serious vein. I went back to my old college textbook, Basic Issues of American Democracy, Hillman M. Bishop and Samuel Hindell. And I decided to go back, how many years would that be? I got my Ph.D. in 1957. That's how many years? 40-some years, isn't it? 30. How many? Well, then it's 34, 35 years ago. What is democracy and democracy attack and defense? What limits on free speech in a democracy? Topic 8, free speech under the Constitution. First article, I like the page number too, page 77. Freedom of speech in wartime. A Supreme Court decision on the subject, and I thought I would read that a little bit tonight. Plus, got a little bit of Hitler's Mein Kampf. I'm not sure I'll identify which, when I'm reading from him, I think I'll just read it since it's a public domain now. And let you see if Saddam has learned. And if our press is serving the Hitler-esque formula in the way in which they are allowing Saddam Hussein to manipulate the media to the harm of our troops, to the erosion of the will of America that is committed to a democracy and a vote has been cast by the representatives of the people. No president has ever been elected with as great a percentage as the vote was in both the Senate and the House. But of course, the way they characterize everything, they're going to focus in on how many were against it. Well, they lost. And they then joined in a resolution of support. And do you notice how often the media talks about how close the vote was to back the UN resolution and how seldom they bring up the fact that the same Congress voted a support resolution after that fact? You probably can't even remember how overwhelming the majority vote was to back the effort once the vote had been cast. They tried Hitler's journalist in Tokyo Rose for treason. War places a different criteria. When the vote for war has come, a whole set of different rules come in to play. And I'm tired of hearing the garbage comparing the role of the press and the freedom of the press in Vietnam versus now. No war was declared in Vietnam. That's the big difference, and a critical difference. You can't commit treason criticizing an act of the executive branch when war has not been voted under the Constitution. But there has been a constitutionally adequate declaration of war. And apparently, the press have felt their self-proclaimed right to rule this nation for so long. They will not accept the fact that we are at war. I still remember one voice, one King's House calling in and saying, they called one of the networks and made some comments about us being at war, and the one on the other end of the phone said, "This is not war. This is an engagement or some other kind of, I can't remember the word, but they substituted some other word for war." And our King's House says, "Well, then why are you advertising your coverage, America at War?" And got hung up on. So I'm going to deal with these things tonight. Now, here's a teacher at a Christian college in Texas. Says, "Dear Gene, this note's just to express how much I love the freedom and grace you teach. You're a breath of fresh air. I've been teaching at this college for 20 years. I do teach freedom and grace, too. The obedience comes naturally when you let God in to rearrange your life and set you free. If we teach faith plus nothing, as Paul did, God will make the believer become faithful. Hebrews 10:14 says it best in the Greek text, and I agree. And then he says, you're right on the media, and the best part is that no one can pigeonhole you except maybe God." And then here's a little article from the Grand Prairie News, January 31st, 1991. Is that the year we're in?
Yes.
"Note to the News Media" by Nancy Hom. Commentary, lighten up, please. Come around here with a camera. "As one who sits on the generating side of words which appear in the newspaper at least once a week, these particular words do not come easily for me. Nevertheless, based on the media interference in the current Mideast conflict," take a picture of this, "here goes. Could we, the people, take one more look at that First Amendment? That freedom of the press clause seems to be interfering with the purpose of the United States Constitution. Specifically, those points regarding, quote, to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessing of liberty to ourselves and our posterity," end quote. Obviously, our founding fathers, men of vision though they were, had no way of foreseeing Ted Turner and his CNN. Initially, freedom of the press was as crucial to democracy as the concept of taxation, only with representation. Yet somewhere along the line, the public's right to know was seized and held hostage by opportunists who would use the press as a propaganda machine. And I would comment here, we have watched the Fifth Amendment be seized by criminals and abused that wonderful privilege that originally was designed as a reaction to the Star Chambers, where someone would come in and there was insufficient evidence to convict them, and they were required to sign an ex officio oath. And the ex officio oath pledged them to tell the truth or face penalties as bad as the penalties for the crime they were charged with. Then, since the Star Chamber had officially predetermined that they were guilty, there was no longer any need to search for evidence. Once the ex officio oath was signed, you then were asked to admit your guilt under torture without torture. In fact, one person came in with a near-dead defendant in tow, saying, "This evil fellow, before torture, during torture, and after torture, refuses to tell the truth about his guilt." You then would be charged with violating the ex officio oath for not admitting your guilt, since the guilt had already been prejudged. And it was against that background that the Fifth Amendment was added. But we have watched criminals, known criminals, so seize that right and hold it hostage until ordinary citizens, by the press primarily, have been so placed on the defensive that they are pretty much adjudged to be guilty if they even utilize in good conscience the Fifth Amendment. As churches over the last several years have been made suspect of heinous crimes, if they have decent and genuine theological reasons for giving in secret, that their Heavenly Father might reward them in secret and have genuine convictions about laying up treasures in heaven, the failure to violate those individual donor records by the media has been made a suspect thing, where if you have nothing to hide, why don't you open up? Well, you've got a lot to hide if you're hiding people's eternal reward by contract with them and their rights of secrecy and giving. Now, this same media that's taken other rights from us by their warped attack on rights that do not specifically reach to their private agendas are now holding the nation hostage to the freedom of the press clause. But I'm commenting on this commentary's points. The public's right to know was seized and held hostage by opportunists who would use the press as a propaganda machine. I hope you realize how difficult this is for me. I firmly believe in a free press, yet I am incensed by the media's interference in the war with Iraq. This is not some letter to the paper by a non-news person. This is a journalist with conscience and responsibility. Nancy Ham, Grand Prairie News, January 31st, 91. I hope you realize how difficult this is for me. I firmly believe in a free press, yet I am incensed by the media's interference in the war with Iraq. Maybe it is my pen and ink, black and white, paper press posture, but I focus most of the blame on the electronic media, and I agree with her. Television and radio, after all, have the advantage of immediacy with less responsibility for integrity, such as the written word must bear. Because when you put something in writing, it had better be right. The ink of history is indelible. Conversely, a live newscast can change direction in a mid-sentence. Further, it is subject to selective editing and re-editing, and most videotapes will not stand the test of time. Only the very best broadcast will make the archives, and, quote, best will likely be determined as those reports which most accurately depict the countenance of the conflict. Sensationalism is but a momentary advantage. Integrity is eternal. I have followed every moment of the war coverage on both my favorite local news, Channel 8 and CNN. In the early hours of the war, the constant coverage was intense and exciting, and I wouldn't have had it any other way. I admire and respect the courage of those reporters on location, as well as the patience and professionalism of the anchors holding it all together. I do not, however, approve of their need to, quote, speculate when details become sparse for whatever reason. I don't like the way reporters pry and prod at Pentagon and White House officials for details which would conflict with security needs. I absolutely abhor the way the TV networks provide unlimited free airtime to Saddam Hussein. As Dr. Gene Scott pointed out, Saddam would be virtually unable to unite terrorists in an attack on America without the assistance of the European and American press. What would he do? Send out a billion chain letters? Quote, if you're a terrorist, please plant a bomb in a U.S. facility, add your name to the bottom of this list, and send this letter to six other Iraqi sympathizers for terrorists? No way. Forget missiles and chemical warfare. The European and American press are Iraq's most dangerous weapon. The airways have become the antithesis of Radio Free Europe. Cut him off. Black him out like a vile, evil, nasty old cigarette commercial. You banned Annie Rooney, now banish Saddam Hussein from the airways. Come on. Come on, program directors. This is a free country. Americans want to win this war, to remain for the most part united and keep our spirits up for the men and women who are giving their best in the Persian Gulf. We do not want to be subjected to the 1991 version of Tokyo Rose. Furthermore, please stop airing those interviews with our captured pilots and crew members. Doubtless Iraq will continue to stage the scenarios for a time, but if we simply say, thank you very much, hand those tapes over to the military intelligence, and let that be the end of it, they'll have no further reason to make the tapes. Give us a break. We have no lack of fiction in this country. There are bestsellers, romance novels, television shows, movies, and the National Enquirer. Trust me, we are entertained, and we don't need contrived tapes of captured career servicemen to ease the boredom of our cushy American lifestyles. Attention, media moguls. We appreciate your involvement and the risk you reporters have taken to keep us informed on the war in the Gulf. But I am sure we won't lose sleep wondering about the exact location of missile hits in Israel and Saudi Arabia. Please don't do reconnaissance for Iraq in the name of that false idol, the public's right to know. Give it a rest, will you? Cover the press conferences at the Pentagon and the White House, interview with the experts, and run that file footage, but don't become the Iraqi news network. Nancy Hamm is a writer for Dallas-Fort Worth suburban newspapers, publisher of the Grand Prairie News, and the opinions expressed are her own, it says, because this must have been carried, I hope, far and wide. That's about as concise and brilliant a piece I've read in a long time on the subject. You know, people are listening. Here's the cartoon of the night. Here's old Saddam clasping his hands, come in close enough to see his ugly face. Old Saddam, the Saddamizer. He's talking to his military advisors. Get in close on him, I'll handle the rest of it. He says, never mind troop movements and body counts. How are my overnight Nielsens? Well, here's a contrast. On the left, Top Gun. On the right, Top Gum. Get in close on each one of them. Let's look at Top Gun first. Now look at Top Gum. What did you think of the media playing today Saddam's comment that it was hypocrisy and mockery for Bush to call for a day of prayer today? It's just too coincidental the way in which the media loves to parrot Saddam expressing their own views. The reason they chose to parrot Saddam, saying Bush calling for every home, every business, every church to pray today is because that's the way the media feels. They have no respect for prayer. So they cannot let the coverage go out without hiding behind the ugly mask of Saddam to have Saddam say what the media really feels, that the call to prayer is hypocrisy and mockery. That's the way the media feels. They just feel so good that they can have Saddam say it. They're an evil force in this nation, opportunists who have stolen the First Amendment from us. We don't have to rewrite the Constitution. We just have to let them feel our wrath. And there are people that can get excited about something for a short time but can't maintain the intensity. You keep the letters going in. The thing that impresses me the most is she references me without having to identify me. That means a lot of people are listening. A lot of people are listening. And your letters are being felt. Write one a day if it's only a one-liner. You're full of you-know-what. Just keep writing. Get on telephone. Now, we welcome those that joined us this half hour. We're live, as we are every Sunday night. I cannot impress upon those of you who listen on Sunday night the importance of getting a shortwave radio. We are on every single night, 7 days a week, 365 days out of the year from now on. On eight, I got a mental block, 9785, the frequency on the 31-meter band on your shortwave radio from 8 p.m. West Coast time until midnight. Let me repeat that. 7 days a week, 365 days out of the year from now on, 9785 on your shortwave radio, 31-meter band. You can hear as clear as a bell all over Texas, all over Mexico, all over the Caribbean, clear down to Chile, clear up to Toronto, all over these United States. 9785, dial it in. My 79-year-old mother, we bought a shortwave radio, strung a 47-foot aerial out in the tree behind her apartment, set a timer, and I come on at 8 o'clock every night, West Coast time, go off at midnight, whether she's there or not. Too many people have an idea of shortwave radio as some kind of squawk box, like every other electronic and technical instrument of communication. Shortwave radios have progressed like every other communication device. You can hear us clear as a bell if you're interested in the teaching. You want to stay in touch every day. Of course, we're always up there 24 hours a day on Westar 5, Transponder 1X. And some of you pick us up on Sunday night when we're on another satellite feeding into some of the Sunday night stations. But 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, we're on Westar 5, Transponder 1X until it dies, and then we'll have another one. Indeed, we're already negotiating the replacement, because it will die sometime in 1992. You can listen by satellite every single day. But shortwave is going to be with us from now till Jesus comes. And we will expand the time, not diminish it. Now you can listen seven nights a week, 8 p.m. to midnight. Many of you who just, that's West Coast time, and many of you who just tuned in, can also pick up 1610 AM, the Clear Channel station out of Anguilla, British West Indies. So a lot of people call and say, well, you're only on 2 hours on Sunday night. Some people say, your message is not finished when you go off. Well, get a shortwave radio. Turn the sound in. If by the time we go off television, you don't think the message is worth hearing the rest of it, you're lucky. But if you want to hear the rest of it, have the shortwave radio on. And we're there 7 nights a week. And I just read an article by a commentator who resides apparently in the Dallas-Fort Worth area about the media. I'm going to read it again before this two-hour segment is finished. But I've also dug my old college textbook out, Basic Issues of American Democracy. And I'm going to read a section on free speech in wartime as I continue to react to what I consider to be the abuse of the privilege of free speech by news media entities who want to be international when they are made to account for the use of their free speech to the harm of this country in wartime, but still want the benefits of American privilege when it serves their purpose. They're screaming American free speech, but want to be a citizen of the world. And it doesn't go both ways. With privilege comes responsibility. My old college textbook goes back a long time. I finished my PhD at Stanford in 1957. Basic Issues of American Democracy. I'm reading this because it goes clear back to 1919. And you don't have to take any more calls. You can be courteous and finish the ones that you have. But I'm reading this, though it goes back to 1919, because it's an opinion by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., one of the more famous justices to sit on the Supreme Court throughout its history. It's a reversal contributing or judging error to the District Court of the United States for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. 1919 is a long time ago. I'm sure that there'll be some who'll shepherdize this case quickly. And there are many more recent cases, including those that cite this case. But I want to read Justice Holmes' words, written as long ago as during the First World War. The issue's not new at all. Mr. Justice Holmes delivered the opinion of the court. This is an indictment in 3 counts. The first charge, or the first charge, is a conspiracy to violate the Espionage Act of June 15th, 1917, cites the statutes, by causing and attempting to cause insubordination in the military and naval forces of the United States, and to obstruct the recruiting and enlistment service of the United States when, and that's the issue, I'm tired of the comparisons with, now I want you to bring your phone calls to a close as quickly as you can. I'm tired of the comparisons drawn with Vietnam. Brad, do your job. I'm tired of the comparisons drawn with Vietnam. This is not to be compared with Vietnam. It's to be compared with the Second World War. We have a declaration of war. There was no declaration of war in Vietnam. We're at war. And the charges, a conspiracy to violate the Espionage Act of June 15, 1917, by causing and attempting to cause insubordination in the military and naval forces of the United States, and to obstruct the recruiting and enlistment service of the United States, when the United States was at war with the German Empire, to wit, that the defendants willfully conspired to have printed and circulated to men who had been called and accepted for military service under the Act of May 18, 1917, a document set forth and alleged to be calculated to cause such insubordination and obstruction. The count alleges overt acts in pursuance of the conspiracy, ending in the distribution of the document set forth. The second count alleges a conspiracy to commit an offense against the United States, to wit, to use the mails for the transmission of matter declared to be non-mailable by Title 12, Article 2 of the Act of June 15, 1917, to wit, the above-mentioned document, with an averment of the same overt acts. The third count charges an unlawful use of the mails for the transmission of the same matter and otherwise as above. Pretty tame stuff compared to what's being fed out through the television. The defendants were found guilty on all the counts. They set up the First Amendment to the Constitution forbidding Congress to make any law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, and bringing the case here on that ground, and have argued some other points also of which we must dispose. The document in question, upon its first printed side, recited the first section of the 13th Amendment, said that the idea embodied in it was violated by the Conscription Act, and that a conscript is little better than a convict, the argument being that the draft violated Article 13 of the Constitution's prohibition against involuntary servitude or slavery. Not too relevant right now, because we have a voluntary army. But they were arguing an amendment, and the 13th Amendment is just as important as the First Amendment, that the draft was involuntary servitude. And I think on its face, prima facie, it is. You are being conscripted. So they had a plausible argument. In impassioned language, it intimated that conscription was despotism in its worst form, and a monstrous wrong against humanity in the interest of Wall Street's chosen few. If we were to do it now, it'd be no draft for oil. It said, quote, "Do not submit to intimidation, but in form at least confine itself to peaceful measures, such as a petition for the repeal of the act." The other and later printed side of the sheet was headed, quote, "Assert your rights." End quote. It stated reasons for alleging that anyone violated the Constitution when he refused to recognize, quote, "your right to assert your opposition to the draft," and went on, quote, "If you do not assert and support your rights, you are helping to deny or disparage rights which it is the solemn duty of all citizens and residents of the United States to retain. I bet you could have organized peace marches on that. It described the arguments on the other side as coming from cunning politicians and a mercenary capitalist press, and even silent consent to the conscription law as helping to support an infamous conspiracy. It denied the power to send our citizens away to foreign shores to shoot up the people of other lands, and added that words could not express the condemnation such cold-blooded ruthlessness deserves, and winding up, quote, "You must do your share to maintain, support, and uphold the rights of the people of this country," end quote. Of course, the document would not have been sent. Of course, the TV broadcasts of Saddam's propaganda material would not have been broadcast unless it had been intended to have some effect back to Holmes. Of course, the document would not have been sent unless it had been intended to have some effect. And we, the court that is, do not see what effect it could be expected to have upon persons subject to the draft, except to influence them to obstruct the carrying of it out. I mean, what effect is the TV broadcasting of Saddam's propaganda machine of so-called bombing of innocent citizens in Iraq? By the way, that screaming woman saying we're human beings seemed a bit incongruous in Baghdad with her slacks and her good English. I mean, where is the research by any journalist to see, is we got another Tokyo Rose here that staged the event? What effect do they propose to have on the troops and the pilots showing them this, if it is not to influence them to stop taking their assignments and flying their bombing missions? The defendants do not deny that the jury might find against them on this point, but it is said, suppose that that was the tendency of this circular, it is protected by the First Amendment to the Constitution. Two of the strongest expressions are said to be quoted respectively from well-known public men. It may well be that the prohibition of laws abridging the freedom of speech is not confined to previous restraints, although to prevent them may have been the main purpose, as intimated, and they cite another case. We admit, the court says, that in many places and in ordinary times, let me say this slow, Oliver Wendell Holmes writing the opinion, we admit that in many places and in ordinary times, the defendants, in saying all that was said in the circular, would have been within their constitutional rights in many places and in ordinary times. But the character of every act depends upon the circumstances in which it is done, citing Aikens versus Wisconsin. The most stringent protection of free speech would not protect a man in falsely shouting fire in a theater and causing a panic. It does not even protect a man from an injunction against uttering words that may have all the effect of force, citing Gompers versus Buckstove and Range Company. The question in every case is whether the words used are used in such circumstances and are of such a nature as to create a clear and present danger that they will bring about the substantive evils that Congress has a right to prevent. It is a question of proximity and degree. When a nation, this is the Supreme Court speaking, when a nation is at war, many things that might be said in time of peace are such a hindrance to its effort that their utterance will not be endured so long as men fight, and that no court could regard them as protected by any constitutional right. It seems to be admitted that if an actual obstruction of the recruiting service were proved, liability for words that produce that effect might be enforced. The statute of 1917 in Article 4 punishes conspiracies to obstruct as well as actual obstruction. If the act, speaking or circulating a paper, its tendency and the intent with which it is done are the same, we perceive no ground for saying that success alone or causing the effect desired warrants making the act a crime, citing Goldman versus United States. Indeed, that case might be said to dispose of the present contention if the president covers all media concludendi. But as the right to free speech was not referred to specially, we have thought fit to add a few words reversing and holding. They had to shut their mouth because, to repeat the heart and soul of Holmes' opinion, we admit that in many places and in ordinary times, the defendants, in saying all that was said in the circular, would have been within their constitutional rights. File all of Saddam's crap. And in discussions when the war is over, play it to their heart's content. But in times of war, the circumstances and the timing, when a nation is at war, many things that might be said in time of peace are such a hindrance to its effort that their utterance will not be endured so long as men fight, and no court could regard them as protected by any constitutional right. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., United States Supreme Court. We're at war, and the media ought to quit serving Saddam Hussein's evil purposes. I play this. I'm going to show you this cartoon again if you can get over here real fast. The earlier audience has already seen it. It's good enough to show again. Here's Saddam meeting with his planners. Get a close-up on Saddam's face. I'm ready when you are. How do we get the picture? There we go. Move in on his face a bit so we can see Saddam's face. See the look on his face and his hands clasped? He's saying to his aides, never mind troop movements and body counts. How are my overnight Nielsens? I have more from my old textbook. Freedom must defend itself. Now, to those who joined us this half hour, I have pulled out my old college textbook. I received my doctorate from Stanford in 1957, so you know how far that goes back. Basic Issues of American Democracy. Tired of the media selling us this bill of goods that the present situation of the Gulf War is to be compared to the Vietnam affair and to the freedom of the media in the Vietnam conflict. There was no declaration of war against Vietnam. That's a simple but very important distinction. We are now a nation at war, and the media has responsibility, and there are those that seek to have an international position. Then they ought to ask the United Nations Assembly to give them some kind of passport and some kind of citizenship and quit trying to take the benefits of being an American and abusing the responsibilities. Then they ought to ask the United Nations Assembly to give them some kind of passport and some kind of citizenship and quit trying to take the benefits of being an American and abusing the responsibilities. We are a nation at war. And I'm going to read a section in this textbook, Freedom Must Defend Itself. But after those that just joined us, check in. Listen closely. Propaganda's task is, for instance, not to evaluate the various rights, but far more to stress exclusively the one that is to be represented by it. It has not to search into truth as far as this is favorable to others in order to present it then to the masses with doctrinary honesty, but it has rather to serve its own truth uninterruptedly. Let me say that again very slowly. Propaganda's task is, for instance, not to evaluate the various rights, but far more to stress exclusively the one that is to be represented by it. It has not to search into truth as far as this is favorable to others, in order to present it then to the masses with doctrinary honesty, but it has rather to serve its own truth uninterruptedly. As soon as by one's own propaganda, even a glimpse of right on the other side is admitted, the cause for doubting one's own right is laid. Want that real slow? As soon as by one's own propaganda, even a glimpse of right on the other side is admitted, the cause for doubting one's own right is laid. The masses are not in a position to distinguish where the wrong of the others ends and their own begins. In this case, they become uncertain and mistrusting, especially if the enemy does not produce the same nonsense, but in turn burdens their enemy with all and the whole guilt. What is more easily explained than that finally one's own people believe more in the enemy's propaganda, which proceeds more completely and more uniformly than in one's own? This, however, may be said most easily of a people which suffers so severely from the mania of objectivity as the American people does. For now they will take pains not to do an injustice to the enemy, even at the risk of the severest strain on or destruction of his own nation and state. You know who wrote that? Mein Kampf, Adolf Hitler, telling his German people why they lost the First World War. As I have shown you with a great deal of evidence, the ideologue the man whose writings produced the philosophic base of the Ba'ath Party, A. Flock, Michel or Michael A. Flock, studying at the Sorbonne, student of Hitler and Hitler's Germany, student of Mussolini and Mussolini's Germany, student of Stalinism, and student of Trotsky's reasons for the failure of the revolution, that ideologue recommended Saddam Hussein for his position to head up the internal security force that became the power base for his takeover of Iraq and the Ba'ath Party, having spent 20 years now with a population 40% of whom are under 25 years of age, in a nation where the children have been taught to turn on their parents, who has invested his entire energy in invading the minds of the young and shaping them in the ideologue of his party to where the party is more important and treason is an act against an abstract people, in classic fascism philosophy where an elite knows what's best for the masses and democracy is working the will of this elite for the good of the masses as viewed by this elite. And the public is this abstract mass that's coming into shape in the image of this elite And thus it is always progressing, never quite getting there. And treason becomes any act that interferes with the party's purposes for the masses, which is the well-being, as they view it, of that mass. Where every member is an informer against others, and the highest treason, I repeat, is to interfere with the will of the party, and that party is personified, incarnate, in the worship of the person Saddam as the great leader. And with a generation 20 years indoctrinated, unlike a mature, learned, objective, educated population that Adolf Hitler started on, Adolf Hitler points out the propaganda machine, unified in its message, admitting no wrongs or guilt of any kind, not even attempting to be objective, recognizing that the least concession that the other side has a right, however minor, weakens the commitment to the holy righteousness of the propaganda cause, because they say the same thing without deviation, though it is a lie and there's no adherence to truth. Coming up against an opponent who is weakened in its perennial search for truth and its objectivity and its willingness to hear the other side, the propaganda will win out over the masses. Now, in the long run, truth will out. But this was the mistake of the thinking, objective, particularly theological clergyman in Hitler's Germany who could have stopped him, who continued to idealize and believe that the choice was between war or democracy, confronting a tyrant who recognized that abandonment of truth was the way and unity in lying was the way to win over those that seek truth, was able to lead the world to the brink of destruction. We're at war. And the media is becoming the mouthpiece, worldwide and entrenched, billions of dollars invested in airtime as a ready-made lie machine, consistently telling its warped, self-serving view. And the media, in the interest of objectivity, weakens the will of America because they will not critically point out that the words coming from Baghdad cannot be put on a scale of moral value and weight with the attempts of the military for security reasons to withhold certain facts, but when they do talk, they attempt to tell the truth. As witness the painful revelation of friendly fire killing some soldiers. Saddam has applied Mein Kampf. You don't continue to communicate to a worldwide audience of masses, by and large beneath the educational level of the United States living listening audience, and equate propaganda with objective journalism. My old textbook, Basic Issues of American Democracy, I pulled it off of my library shelf one day this week. Thought I'd read this to you. Freedom Must Defend Itself by Max Eastman. Democracy is on the defensive. Democracy is on the defensive in the domestic as well as the foreign field. The spearhead of the totalitarian attack is the work of fascist and Stalinist conspirators within the democratic countries. Now, this was written many years ago. As I told you, it was one of the accompanying textbooks in one of my classes way back, and I graduated with a PhD from Stanford in 1957. This was an undergraduate class, so I'm sure we're in the early 1950s. Democracy is on the defensive in the domestic as well as the foreign field. The spearhead of the totalitarian attack is the work of fascist and Stalinist conspirators within the democratic countries. This spearhead is not directed against the armed forces. It is not directed primarily against factories and munitions. It is directed against the vital essence of democracy, those customs, laws, principles, and ways of life which make it worth defending. In fighting this mortal danger, Democrats find themselves in a dilemma. The democratic way of life, honestly lived, involves granting to minorities the right to advance their views. If that right is denied to the totalitarians, and to bring it up to date, to the point of view of Saddam Hussein, for example, democracy seems to be destroying itself. Say it again. If that right, let's say the whole thing, the democratic way of life honestly lived, this was the confusion of the idealists and the clerics of Hitler Germany, to those among the journalistic world who are honest, and there are some. They are members of a community, all of whom have been saying the same thing for so long that they are themselves victims of their rhetoric. The democratic way of life, honestly lived, involves granting to minorities the right to advance their views. If that right is denied to the totalitarians, Arafat, the rat, Gaddafi, the killer, Saddam, the sodomizer, if that right is, and Hitler, if that right is denied to the totalitarians, democracy seems to be destroying itself. If it is freely granted, as idealistic Democrats would say, democracy seems to be surrendering to its enemies without a fight. What are we going to do about this? Should American citizens who are striving toward power with a view to destroying democracy, or now that we have the news media fed into our home who have nominated themselves international citizens and thus free of any responsibility to be an American, while all the time claiming every right of an American. So not only as in this day, American citizens striving toward power inside domestically with a view to destroying democracy, namely taking over, you could say this equally about those externally who have one goal, and that is to destroy America and replace it with dictatorship under a tyrant like Saddam. Should people like that have the full enjoyment of democratic rights, which is what the media is doing, playing all these different views? And I'm giving credit to those that honestly hold the view. Some are just low-down traitors. serving their own selfish ends. But let's, for a moment, since I've been attacking the corrupt elements of the media, let's address those that are sincerely gripped with an ideal they feel they must serve, the God of two sides, that democracy demands, giving everyone a voice, even those whose dedicated purpose is to bring democracy down and replace it with the tyranny and racism of Saddam Hussein. Should people like that, with such a view to destroying democracy and dictatorship under a tyrant, have the full enjoyment of democratic rights? It seems obvious to intellectual logic that they should. Logically, it is required that they should. And that's what the little twit will be parroting when you call the various news agencies that have now geared themselves up with their prepared rhetoric to the complaints of the American public. Because to intellectual logic, Saddam's entitled to a view and a voice. It seems as obvious to practical common sense that they should not. Now, what you going with? Intellectual logic, practical common sense. Common sense is backed up by the testimony of refugees from tyrant states. This was written in the 50s. It was only the liberality of their government toward totalitarian conspirators, they tell us, which made possible the overthrow of democracy. Pure logic is backed up by organizations like the American Civil Liberties Union, which not only give legal counsel to agents of the communist conspiracy, but actually lacerate themselves from time to time by defending avowed fascists in their right to organize tyranny. This writer says, although I share their interest in good logic, I think the position of the Civil Liberties Union is theoretically as well as practically wrong. I was discussing this one day with Arthur Garfield Hayes, their very able attorney and the most consistent libertarian among them. I found that he was not quite purely logical about it after all. He had his own supplementary argument from common sense. He would assert first that democracy stands or falls with the right of the minority to free expression, and that at least infringement of this right is the beginning of the end of democracy. Or that rather any least infringement of this right is the beginning of the end of democracy. And you'll have some little twit prepare a speech and tell you that if we're not willing to give Saddam a voice, however wrong he might be, that bit of censorship, if we're not willing to tell where the scuds land and how many are killed every day, and how many weapons don't function, and how poor the gas masks are, and give more time to a traitorous AWOL who is nothing in Patton's word but a bleepity-bleep coward than we do to those that are fighting and dying for freedom, that somehow or other, democracy itself has had planted within itself the seeds of destruction, because the democratic way of life requires giving them a voice. All sincere believers in free speech must, he said, as a matter of good faith, grant this right to those who don't believe in it, like Saddam, who wants to take charge so he can stop the free speech he's now enjoying, because he only wants his own speech to be free. But then after a while, in another mood, I would find Arthur Garfield Hayes, who had made that argument, making a more practical argument. Quote, He would say, the best way to do away with a bad idea is to let everybody discuss it with perfect freedom. End quote. These two arguments are present, I think, in the minds of the most extreme devotees of free speech. They are the arguments with which Mrs. Roosevelt and others have justified their patronizing of front organizations manipulated by communists. They are the usual arguments, and they are commonly assumed to be identical. One, however, is a logical inference from an abstract dogma regarded as having absolute validity. The other is a conclusion based on a statement of empirical fact. You can't have it both ways. As to the dogma, it is certainly more appropriate than most dogmas to the uses of democracy. Free speech for minorities is, generally speaking, of the essence of democratic procedure. But in their hearts, even the dogmatists know, if they're well educated, that social life is too complex to be regulated by dogmas. In order that the citizens of a democratic society may live even with safety, the principle of free speech has to be limited by the criminal law, and is referenced in another Oliver Wendell Holmes opinion of the Supreme Court. You can't falsely cry fire in a crowded theater and call it free speech and jeopardize the lives of those who flee in panic. No man and no minority is free to spread libel or advocate specific acts of murder under the guise of free speech. There is no logical reason why these limitations should not be extended to make safe the existence of the democratic society itself. If there are limitations on free speech in the common sense world which deny you the right to be exempt from criminal consequences to advocate a specific act of murder because it is constitutionally protected free speech, you claim, the same logic requires that similar limitations for the whole society on occasions must be applied. The reason is a practical one. Laws passed to protect democracy from minorities conspiring against its existence may, and at times certainly will, be used to suppress legitimate minority opinion within its framework. This is so real and extreme a danger to democracy that in most times and places, it is a lesser risk to extend complete freedom to those who aim to strangle freedom. Whatever that ceases to be the lesser risk, however, this practical reason disappears, and there is, or wherever that ceases to be the lesser risk, namely letting everybody speak, this practical reason disappears and there's nothing but dogma left. As a general principle, it's better to let minorities speak. But when the very society that protects the minority's right to speak is being threatened under the guise of free speech, then common sense says you limit that kind of free speech. And because there are those that would abuse that limitation and always say it is for that purpose, it is therefore legitimate to challenge our government when they want to suppress all free speech because of some kind of security risk. But we are dealing at war with a nation whose dedicated, avowed purpose is to destroy this country and upon its destruction take its place, and then destroy the very Constitution protecting free speech and silence those who have given him free speech en route to such a takeover. Common sense says the dogma has become ridiculous to the point of the extreme, and restrictions that involve in the old classic concept a clear and present danger to the existence of this union. Clear because it is the speech of one who wants to do away with democracy present because we are at war. You shut that voice up. If or when that time comes, those who know how to love freedom, not as an abstract idea, but as a concrete fact, limited as all facts are by the conditioning circumstances, both temporary and inherent in the nature of things, ought to be ready to suspend its purity in order to defend its existence. You follow that?
Yes, sir.
The purest in free speech, when the application of their theory commits one to a path of self-destruct by giving voice to one who wants the very destruction of the pure theory, then one ought to be ready to suspend its purity in order to defend its existence. If republics cannot muster that much flexibility without compromising their essential democratism, they may well go down as the German Republic did and the Italian constitutional monarchy did and Iraq did through mere lack of guts and good sense. It is the teaching of bitter experience. Democratic liberty can never include the liberty to destroy democracy by organized slander. You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
Reading from my old textbook, Basic Issues of Democracy, clear back in the 1950s. If or when that time comes, when those using free speech are using it with the avowed purpose to destroy democracy, those who know how to love freedom, not as an abstract idea, but as a concrete fact, ought to be ready to suspend its purity in order to defend its existence. If republics cannot muster that much flexibility without compromising their essential democratism, they may well go down, as the German Republic did and the Italian constitutional monarchy did, through mere lack of guts and good sense. It is the teaching of bitter experience that democratic liberty can never include the liberty to destroy democracy by organized slander or armed force. As to the assertion that the best way to do away with a bad idea is to let everybody discuss it, that is, like most proverbs, a half-truth, useful when the other half does not happen to be called for. The other half is that the idea backed by the most power and money always wins out over the good idea. Other elements enter into the picture, but these two are sufficient to suggest its complexity. The wonders achieved by the advertising business, so similar in its techniques and ethics to totalitarian propaganda, are sufficient to set us on our guard against this casual proverb. You don't really think that the ideas control and the discussions the media has given. They slant the ideas. In order to keep a foothold, are you so foolish that you don't know that CNN will be around when this war is over? And they are looking to the market in third world countries, and at the expense of thousands of lives at risk in the Gulf states, they're going to kiss the necessary asteroids to keep their foothold or toehold for a future economic market. In our conversation, this writer says, talking of his conversation with Arthur Garfield Hayes, the libertarian attorney who defended the idealism of pure logic democracy, in our conversation, I called Hayes' attention to this and to the fact that he was using these two very different arguments, the dogmatic one of logic and the empirical one that the best way for a bad idea to be done in is to have it discussed in the marketplace. I called his attention to the fact he was using these two very different arguments as though they were the same. I asked him which one he would stand by in the long run, the empirical or the dogmatic one. Suppose, I said, that you were confronted with a situation in which you plainly saw that the continued extension of free speech to an anti-democratic minority would result in the overthrow of democracy. Would you abide by the abstract principle of free speech, or would you save, at the cost of their impairment, the institutions of democracy? And you can expand it from the 50s to today. It is inconceivable that we could lose this war, but we could lose it on a grander scale if our will is sufficiently broken that we do not dismantle the military machine and drive him out of Kuwait and disallow any face-saving of any kind for his moving into Kuwait. And democracy in third world countries will be set back millenniums. Confronting that threat, would you abide by the abstract principle of free speech, or would you save, at the cost of their impairment, the institutions of democracy? That was the choice of the clerics in Hitler Germany. Will you violate the principles of democracy, fight propaganda, fight force, fight lies, and defeat them, go to war with all of its violations of democracy, to put down tyranny in order to save the opportunity for civilized people who believe in democracy and do not want to overthrow it to continue? And they, like this guy, have their heads in the clouds of logic and no common sense, put off the tough choice until the one whose dedicated purpose is to do away with democracy has so seized the reins of power that he accomplishes that. He asked Hayes, would you abide by the abstract principle of free speech, or would you save, at the cost of their impairment, the institutions of democracy? His answer was at that time, quote, "Well, I believe I would go down fighting for the principle." What good's the principle if you go down? I don't mind going down as we did on a principle that involves a business choice. I chose our religious freedom over owning a license that, in my judgment, the church, as a church, never should have owned in the first place, because they immediately involved themselves in unrelated business. Had I been pastor before I came to this church, I would have created a separate taxable holding corporation to get the license. Then there would have been no problem. But because I inherited a problem, I had to choose between keeping a business license for this church or keeping our sacred rites of worship in secret to God. The choice was easy. But in life and death matters, where democracy and the right of religious freedom itself is at stake, I'm going to make the common sense choice. This seems to me, this writer says, a fanatical and not a scientific attitude to say, I believe I'd go down fighting for the principle. Above all, at a time like the present, when democracy is defending itself against totalitarian conspiracies subsidized by foreign governments, defending itself in harm's way and in the spilling of blood in the Gulf, when the Jesuitical use of free institutions for the purpose of their own subversion has developed into a technical and expert art, an art of playing Democrats for suckers, to continue in this antique attitude seems little better than the madness of a fixed idea. The whole truth under the half-truth proverb is that free public discussion of good and bad proposals is essential, not only from the standpoint of the rights of thinking citizens, but from the standpoint of science and the progress of civilization. It is so essential that a considerable latitude ought to be extended even to those who are conspiring by a subsidized propaganda to destroy civilization. They should be held in leash so long as possible by merely denying them the right to arms and uniforms and military drill, by exposing their real aims and educating the public against them. But this, again, is not an absolute or eternal truth. It does not mean that sane people who believe in freedom are required to lie down under a deliberate frame-up of public opinion having the purpose to put an end to freedom itself. The simple fact is that criminal power fiends, madmen, the simple fact is that criminal power fiends are ganging up against human civilization. Their chief weapons are not the sword and pistol or Scud missiles. Their chief weapon is the modern technique of selling ideas to the public, so brilliantly set forth by Adolf Hitler in his Bible of unscrupulousness, Mein Kampf. Are those who understand this fact going to let civilization be destroyed because its further progress depends upon the free discussion of ideas? Will they not, if driven to that point, defend its existence at the cost of some postponement of its purism? If they are flexible and realistic, if they are workers in fact rather than zealots of ideas, they will. It is again a question of science against superstition, of intelligence against blind zeal, a question of recovering from our otherworldly medieval heritage. Those concerned to defend democracy as a thing existing in this world will, in the extreme emergency, stretch out their tolerance, as did the Athenians and the Romans of the Republic, rather than through the tyrannicides than to the conspiracies and conspirators of tyranny. In short, better risk a departure from free speech long enough to whip this son of Belial than, in the purest dedication to free speech itself, give voice to one whose unchanging purpose is to annihilate the fountain of free speech itself. Now, I happen to believe too many in the media know this, but have sold their soul to ratings and scoops and dollars and an international market. But there are some within the media who genuinely are purists, who need to come out of the clouds and understand, and if they don't understand, do some reading in history on the roots of Saddam Hussein, and understand that we are where the clergy and the press was in Hitler Germany, who were purists to objectivity to the point that they became suckers for Nazi propaganda and were used to entrench the very fascistic tyranny that ultimately annihilated their voice. And it's happening today. Saddam Hussein has spent 20 years invading the minds of the children, 40% of the population of that nation,
have been brainwashed into deifying the party and deifying the leader of the party and have one dedicated purpose with a worldwide potential of terrorism to destroy freedom of expression once they have used it to gain a power base, an audience, a platform to promote their ideas designed to destroy free speech, which the media is freely giving them out of an obtuse insanity that they must go down fighting for the right of Saddam Hussein to be heard. He has no right to be heard anywhere in the world. Let him send, as the writer of the article I read earlier, let him send chain letters to Muslims around the world, either through ignorance or greed or perish the thought, unadulterated treason. The media is selling out democracy while all the time defending it as the furtherance of democratic ideals. Don't stop your letter writing.